From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The coronavirus, officially COVID-19, keeps on spreading. Here in the United States, it has become political, part of this year's election campaign, less than 16 weeks until Americans vote on whether to let Donald Trump continue as president. His opponent, the Democrat, former Vice President Joe Biden, is stepping up his campaign, unveiling an economic stimulus plan with a focus on combating climate change. Mr. Trump says he has a good relationship with the government's top expert on infectious diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, but some officials in the White House have been leaking negative information about Anthony Fauci. There's continued reaction to the president's move that canceled the prison sentence of his friend and political advisor, Roger Stone, just before Stone was going to go to prison. And we'll look at how relations between the United States and China have soured. President Trump is blaming China for the coronavirus. He's imposing sanctions and has canceled all the favorable deals with Hong Kong, because that city is now under the thumb of China's security laws. Okay, enough from me. Let's turn to Tom DeFrank. You cover President Trump every day. His approach to coronavirus: the number of deaths in the U.S. was approaching 140,000. He clearly did not like to talk about that, but he did finally wear a mask in public, and the president scolded one of his aides who published an article critical of Dr. Anthony Fauci. So, Tom, what's the Trump policy right now toward COVID-19?
Seems to change all the time. This back and forth about Dr. Fauci, this suggests a White House in a bit of internal disarray. It's very clear that President Trump has been rattled by Dr. Fauci's candor. The president doesn't want to talk about this. He wants to talk about the economy. He wants to talk about getting schools open in the fall, which he thinks is very important. He doesn't want to dwell on the virus. He continues to say we're coming along very well, but all the metrics show that the virus is winning at the moment. And I think the president is frustrated. He demoted his campaign manager in the last several days, and that's another example of his frustration just across the board. So there's a bit of an internal muddle that they're still in the process of sorting out. I mean, it's hard to believe that his special assistant on trade would have done this op-ed in USA Today trashing Fauci without some permission, but the White House is saying no, he went rogue on that. He shouldn't have done that. He didn't have permission, and he did it anyway, which makes you wonder, why is he still there?
Kimberly Adams, you cover politics for Marketplace. I'm thinking back to Tuesday evening when the president announced he'd have an outdoor news conference in the Rose Garden at the White House, and the subject was supposed to be action against China, but his opening statement went on for more than 50 minutes, stream of consciousness, mostly claiming he'd created a great economy that China and COVID-19 ruined, and Joe Biden would be a terrible president. Kimberly, what did you think of that so-called news conference?
Well, it definitely sounded more like a political campaign speech, which has some legal questions around whether or not that's even allowable, but that doesn't seem to stop much of anything in many cases. But it definitely was, you know, as you describe, a lot of things put together in that speech, and the president definitely has made it his ambition to run on the economy. And the before times, as we call them, before the pandemic, we did have a lot of really solid economic numbers, low unemployment rate, and all of that has just been eviscerated. And the economy looks like, you know, we had a little bit of recovery happening in sort of mid-April, early May, and now it just seems to be going back down with this rise in cases. You know, it's hard to talk about anything related to the economy or related to politics without talking about the pandemic and the rising death toll and the rising number of cases and the different parts of the economy having to shut down all over again, and businesses that are closing that thought they were going to make it if they could reopen, but now that they have to shut down again, they may not return. And so the president seems to be flailing a little bit, trying to get this under control or deflect who should be responsible for it.
Well, even in the Rose Garden rant, as some people are calling it, where he spoke about so many things for such a long time, there was some news about international affairs when the president told one reporter that he has no interest in speaking with China's President Xi Jinping and no plan for more trade agreements with China. Tom DeFrank, turning against China, is that going to help Donald Trump politically here at home?
He and his campaign advisors believe so. This is not a new development, Dan. They've been beating up on the Chinese for well over a month when he started calling this the Chinese virus, which in fact it did start in China, in Wuhan. And this is a calculated strategy to go after China. And he and his advisors are convinced that at some point this will deflect some of the blame from him and to the Chinese. And this is calculated. This was not a slip of the tongue. This is one of the overriding strategies of the campaign with, as you said, about 16 weeks to go.
And the president says that he's always believed in America first. You mentioned the word blame. And Kimberly, I mean, all of this, whether it's someone in the White House, that advisor, Peter Navarro, writing an article critical of Dr. Anthony Fauci, just signs of tension, you know, even within the administration. Do you also think it's a blame game for the more than 130,000 deaths in this country?
I think that the American people are looking for leadership on this. And in the lack of leadership, they are looking for blame in many cases. Who is responsible? And I think if you're the Biden campaign in particular, you definitely want to shape your message and your narrative around sort of the buck stops here mentality, which, you know, has traditionally been the role of the president, but has not necessarily been the role of this president. And if I could just follow up quickly on the point about China and Trump distancing himself from President Xi and all of these things. If you think about, you know, the last year or so leading up to the pandemic, trade policy and trade agreements with China were a huge part of what was moving the markets and what was going on in the economy, whether or not China was going to make agricultural purchases, whether or not items had to be made in the United States to be exempt from tariffs and all these different tariff policies. And we were on a pathway towards stability in regards to trade relations. And so that has sort of gone out the window in addition to many other things. And so the souring of that economic relationship, in addition to that political relationship, is going to have some lasting consequences. But yes, I think this sort of who is to blame for the problems in the economy? You know, you have all of these state and local officials trying to decide whether or not to have masking requirements or whether or not to open and close businesses, whether or not to have kids go back to school in the fall. And while the president is really pushing his allies and local leaders to keep going and to keep the economy open, to reopen schools, local officials who are a lot closer to their constituents in many ways are facing a lot of blowback and a lot of people who are unwilling to allow some of these measures that the president wants.
Well, sure, you're mentioning local leaders. And well, sometimes the world needs a reminder that in the U.S. we have a federal system where there's a federal government, the national government. But we hear increasingly during this crisis about the governors of the 50 states. They are decision makers, as well as mayors and the leaders of counties all over the country. Now, many of them who are Republicans are showing loyalty to President Trump by rushing to reopen restaurants and workplaces. They say they want to have a strong economy. They even claim that an economic shutdown kills people. Governors who are Democrats generally disagree with the White House, and those governors say they're putting health before economic growth. Now, Tom, when you look at it now and everything that's happened since the month of February, has it hurt the United States that we don't have one national policy, or we never would have one?
Well, I think it does and has, Dan. I mean, it's interesting. Critics of President Trump point to the European Union, where the numbers are down, and many countries have come through this in better shape than the United States at the moment. And one of the reasons for the success of controlling the virus in places like Germany and other Western European countries, not all, of course, is that they had a national policy, a federal policy, if you will. And here in the U.S., it's very decentralized and it's become fragmented. I think it's interesting that you have some Republicans starting to worry about this. I mean, of all places, Alabama, where Alabama may be the state where President Trump is more popular than any place else. Just recently, the governor of Alabama said mandatory mask wearings if you're outside your home or outside your office. And that's the last place I would have thought something like that happened, because I think they're starting to get very worried. In Georgia, for instance, Georgia, within the last week, had more than 15,000 cases reported in a single day, which, to put that in perspective, is more than the number of cases on the worst day in New York City, which we all know has been the epicenter, at least at one point, of all of this. So you have 50 different states and hundreds of other jurisdictions, schools, jurisdictions, trying to grapple with this. And California, the nation's most populous state, has already rolled back many of its reopenings. They're regressing. And of course, the president is not a fan of that. You're seeing here the downside to a lack of a national strategy.
Kimberly, the other day, you know, there was a lot of negative reaction, of course, by Trump critics when the news came out that hospitals across the country were told to report directly to President Trump's Department of Health and Human Services how many patients are coming in, who's in critical condition, etc., and not to the more independent Centers for Disease Control. Has that turned out to be a big story, or just a small indicator of something?
Feels like everything is such a big story these days. It's hard to pick and choose which one is out in the forefront. And I'll also sort of give the caveat that I'm here in Washington, D.C., where our news cycle and what people view as important can be very different from what other folks in the rest of the country think. But it's a huge story here in Washington, I will say that, because it really looks at the sort of control of the flow of information, the idea that these numbers are bad and they're getting worse, and that the Trump administration wants to control them. Now, you know, you can't automatically say that they're going to change the numbers or limit the numbers or limit the availability of numbers. We don't know that. But the president, at least, does have a history of downplaying the severity of this pandemic. And so a lot of researchers, a lot of medical experts, and a lot of local officials as well are very concerned about this, you know, because if you can imagine, if the state next door to you is having a really bad outbreak and a sudden spike, and they send those numbers to the Trump administration and they aren't publicized as quickly as they might have been with the CDC, that can affect how you and your community might react. So there are some risks there.
Well, let's talk about how politicians are balancing the advantages of trying to return to normal life versus the danger that will increase the spread of coronavirus. We'll turn to that and more after this brief halftime break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
As the coronavirus crisis continues, our economy here in the United States has been damaged a lot. Unemployment doubled to around 10% of Americans who want a job but are unable to find one. Kimberly, the special aid, including extra money for the unemployed from the national government, is expiring at the end of this month as Congress returns from a two-week recess. What are we hearing from the two parties about adding more stimulus to the economy?
They're still negotiating what that additional stimulus is going to look like. There's pretty much universal agreement across the board that the economy does need more stimulus. But what that's going to look like is still up in the air. A lot of the Republicans have expressed concern that the $600 extra unemployment insurance, which I know sounds a little wonky for people who might not be in the United States, but when people are out of work, their employers have paid into a system that gives them a portion of their salary when they're out of work, and the government has been supplementing that with an extra $600 payment. That is the thing that's going to be expiring. Some have complained that the generosity of that lump amount being added on is discouraging people from going to look for other jobs or from going back to work. Now, the counter argument is that the pandemic might be what is discouraging people from going back to work, not to mention the fact many businesses still aren't open. there often isn't enough business going into small businesses and companies, not enough people going out and shopping and eating at restaurants to support bringing employees back. So there's a lot of concern that if that payment goes away, it will have some pretty dire economic consequences for some of the most vulnerable and low-income people in the country. And at the same time that that benefit is expiring, eviction moratoriums in many parts of the country that have stopped people who can't pay their rent or mortgage from being evicted from their homes or foreclosed in their homes, those are set to expire at the end of this month also. So it's sort of this double whammy of people who are in economic distress could be facing these two key moments that will put them at even greater risk. And the concern over the economic consequences of this pandemic is so great that you have even some of the big investment banks stepping in and saying, hey, if everybody just wears a mask, I think it was Goldman Sachs coming out and saying, if everyone just wears a mask, we can get this under control. And you have all of these various officials from the Federal Reserve. I was talking to the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, Robert Kaplan, who said, we can limit the economic damage of this pandemic if everyone just wears a mask. But that's not something that we're hearing from the federal government in a more unified way.
Well, yeah, that is the thought, that if people don't breathe on each other, the virus won't spread. That might not bring the spread down to zero. But there's also, what can we say, the fact it's impossible that everyone will wear a mask. There's a lot of blame sometimes pointed at young people who go to the beaches in the summertime, and then they get together and have their social events and parties. So it's impossible to get all of this down to zero. So there's a sense that we have to live with this. So Tom DeFrank, when you look ahead to the political campaign and to Election Day on November 3rd, you know, whether it's the election for president or the Democrats want to keep the House of Representatives, the Republicans want to keep the United States Senate, is the issue of coronavirus inevitably the biggest issue, Tom?
I think it will be, because it has such an impact on the economy. And more to the point, Dan, it has an impact on how people feel. I mean, I've always thought that the best indicator going into a presidential election is what I call the right track, wrong track statistic. And at the moment, well over 60% of the country believes the United States is on the wrong track. Now, you can debate all day long whose fault that is, the Democrats, the Republicans, President Trump. Trump says it's Joe Biden's 47 years in Washington where he didn't do anything. But the bottom line is that people are not feeling good going into an election. That's usually, historically, not a good thing for the party in power. So we will just have to see. But it's fair to say the coronavirus, one, is not yet in check in this country. And two, because of that, it makes people scared. I see more and more people where I live on Capitol Hill, just down from Congress. A month ago, they weren't wearing masks. Now, almost everybody I see is wearing a mask. And that is a change in attitude. But people are becoming increasingly nervous. And that can't be a good metric for the parties in power.
Kimberly, come in on that, if you will, that if this is not good for those in power, we could have some big shifts in November, not only that President Trump could lose to Joe Biden, the Democrat, but Republicans maybe can't hold the Senate. Democrats maybe cannot continue to have their majority in the House. Is anything predictable, Kimberly?
Not much is predictable in this current environment, but you can look to recent history for some portends of what might be happening next. I mean, there's the concern for people who are in power, but this pandemic is striking the poor and low income Black and brown people. It is killing them more and making them sick more, and they're facing greater economic consequences than other groups. And that is triggering quite a bit of mobilization and anger and frustration. People are drawing a pretty straight line between what the government did and did not do, and what our health care does and does not look like, and what unemployment benefits are and are not available to their local leaders and to their national leaders. And if we look back to the last recession, what did we see? We saw the Tea Party sweep into power in Congress on the sort of backs of this great economic upheaval. So I think it's reasonable to expect that not just the trauma of the health crisis, but also the trauma of the economic crisis that many people are feeling is going to yield a great deal of political change at the local and national level.
the two principal candidates for president are both white men in their 70s. And Joe Biden, the Democrat, a former vice president, he hasn't done much campaigning, but he is starting to give a few speeches. We saw him in his state of Delaware, in the neighboring state, Pennsylvania, where he was born. Tom, these were not rallies, no cheering crowds. But Biden apparently does have a strategy, right, to attack Donald Trump as a failure on coronavirus and on world leadership.
That's exactly right. Biden is not going to be doing big rallies. He thinks that is not smart clinically and medically, and he doesn't think it's smart politically as well. I mean, even the Democratic National Convention in August is going to be scaled back. And by making the point that he, Biden, thinks that it's not really that safe to assemble crowds in the traditional campaign election way is a subtle way of saying that, alleging that Donald Trump's policies have failed as well. It's a strategy. It seems to be working, but I always like to say overnight is a lifetime in politics, and many things can happen in the 110 or so days left until November the 3rd.
Joe Biden is ahead of Donald Trump in the national opinion polls. Lots of people in politics say it's still early. What about Joe Biden bringing up the environment? The other day, he put out a program that would cost $2 trillion, he said, to spur economic growth, a lot of focus on climate change. Kimberly, is that a winning issue for Biden?
I think it's among the issues that will appeal especially to younger voters who tend to be a bit more environmentally conscious. But also, he's really tying this to jobs in many ways. So, for example, there's a big emphasis on clean vehicles, like emissions-free vehicles, electric vehicles, and producing those in the United States. A lot of economists and a lot of people are looking around the economic landscape and seeing a lot of jobs that just will not come back from this pandemic, at least not in the next year or two, and a lot of businesses that are going to be shut down. So, you know, even though it's sort of a running joke to talk about infrastructure week, there will need to be jobs created somewhere for many people, and including reskilling. And so Biden and others are making the argument, let's make these jobs in clean energy, let's make these jobs in retrofitting older buildings to make them more energy efficient, let's boost our infrastructure for recharging electric vehicles. And so he's tying it very much to, you know, the environmental message, also environmental justice in terms of whether disadvantaged communities have access to clean air and water and protection from pollution. Also, there's definitely a big jobs push in this, which is probably going to be necessary. President Trump has talked a lot about restricting international trade as a way to protect American jobs, and this is a slightly different take.
The president also mentioned the environment the other day, but in a different way. He, in fact, cleared away some of the environmental limits and regulations. He said big projects like highways, they need to be approved a lot more quickly. President Trump said they will be, and he thinks his voters at least want to see construction projects rather than environmental regulations. Before our time expires, let's just mention the Roger Stone affair. Stone, a longtime Republican campaign strategist, a friend of the president. He was found guilty of lying to Congress, of intimidating a witness in his case. This all had to do with the 2016 campaign. Roger Stone, perhaps a link between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks and maybe even Russia. And yet President Trump decided to commute the prison sentence. Even the $20,000 fine is canceled. Tom DeFrank, Democrats and some others are outraged. But is this the kind of story that's going to fade away long before November?
No, I don't think it will. I mean, I go back to someone I've been talking to in this town for 40 years, a senior Republican consultant, and I said to him, what are some of the things that the president should or should not be doing? And he said, I'll tell you one thing he shouldn't do. He cannot pardon Roger Stone before the election. He said he has to pardon Roger Stone the day after the election, win or lose. And if he pardons him before the election, it's going to be a political minus for him. We will see.
So much to talk about. So many issues, but that's all the time we have. Our thanks to Kimberly Adams, who covers politics for Marketplace, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor of the National Journal. This program is produced here in Washington, D.C. by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravine.